everyone.
Welcome back to another episode of the Empathy Podcast. I'm Holly Custard.
And I'm Nelson Almanzar. Here at the Empathy Podcast, we bring on guests from all walks of life, and we talk about things like compassion, listening, and understanding, and how all these things have an impact on our lives.
That's right. And we get to share stories with our guests to talk about how empathy plays a positive role in our day-to-day. And we're happy to report that it happens a lot more frequently than we might think.
Yes. So before we begin this episode, we want to invite you to connect with us on our website, www.empathypodcast.com, and find us on Facebook and Instagram.
And if you like what you hear, please rate this podcast and share it with your friends.
Great. So thanks for listening. Now let's tune in to this episode of the Empathy Podcast.
This is why empathy as a topic of discussion and placing importance in empathy to me is such an important part of our goal in life as people. Because to be honest with you, part of what I'm trying to do with therapy dog work is to bring people tangibly together to practice compassion. And people don't think of compassion as something that we have to continue to practice. They think of it oftentimes as something that exists or doesn't exist. But I believe that just like a lot of our habits in life, if we can get people thinking more through empathy so that we care about the emotional experience that other people are having, not just I'm sympathetic to your situation, but I have so much sympathy and so much emotion invested in this for another person or another animal that I want to, it's going to move me to do something specifically tangible for somebody.
Oftentimes, Nelson and I will sit down and we'll be chit-chatting about things and catching up on things. And I'll often talk about my kids. I have two boys and they can be challenging at times. And I'll present like, oh, geez, last night this happened. And oh, I don't know what to do. And Nelson always has these great ideas like, well, have you tried this? Or how about thinking about it this way? And
I'm yeah.
Like, that's a great idea. He's like, yeah, I got it from my trainer for Rambo.
Yeah, Rambo, my dog, is where I got trained a couple years ago. And I met Paul through that program. I think, Paul, you got him certified as a canine good citizen. We conducted the test together. And every time Holly and I talk about stuff, and I always like give the disclaimer, like, hey, I know it's not the same thing, you know, kids and humans. That's definitely more complex. But here's what I learned that might be able to help. And usually, you know, 4 out of 5 times, it kind of it helps them out.
Yeah, it's totally spot on.
There's a lot of things that are transferable, actually, between working with kids and working with dogs, especially. And Holly, I also have 2 kids, and I was astounded when I was, as a parent, you know, actually, and Nelson can probably think about the same thing working with dogs and his experiences. You know, when you start researching parenting advice and things like that, there's a million different perspectives. There's 1,000 different books that tell you to do it differently. And, you know, it's hard to kind of wade through some of the information and what you're going to do with your personal choices and your approach to parenting. Just like with dog training, we joke about 1,000 different dog trainers have 1,000 different perspectives. You know, ask a dog trainer a question and we'll all answer it differently in some regards. But during parenting, I remember finding a book series called Love and Logic. And that book series was to a T what I'd been training people with dogs pretty much for years prior to that. So I was really blown away by just a direct parallel between that series and what I'm doing with people and dogs, actually.
So do you think after reading that book and making that realization, do you think it made you a better parent or you became a better dog trainer?
Both, you know, I think that because, you know, part of my perspective and philosophy in life is to always try to continue to educate and seek growth. You know, one of the things that I was told early on by one of my dog training mentors, Lee Manick, so I take a lot of my philosophies and methodology from and approaches in training. He would tell me, and actually a lot of us that was training under him, he would say, learn one new thing from every dog you ever meet. That was his approach. And just to kind of make it a bit more of a microcosm that every dog can show you something if you allow that. If you allow an open mind, whether it be through your successes or your failures, doesn't matter. Those things help you grow and learn. And you should really try hard to look at it through the perspective of the dog. Because, you know, specifically, dogs tend to be at a specific disadvantage than the human kids we're dealing with, in that on some level that's somewhat innate, we have the ability to communicate on a like type of playing ground with our own species. Dogs come into this wired completely differently, and it takes us kind of stepping out of our own perspective and a high level of self-awareness of that to now try to meet the dog in the middle and think and act like a dog might, mm-hmm. to see how we can mediate these conflicts that we have. Because just like with people, I find that human and dog interactions really come down to some personality conflicts sometimes. And so, you know, Lee was always really big about trying to learn from the process, trying to continue that as a way of experiencing the full breadth of the nuances of the animal we're working with, you know? And I think that dogs have individual personalities that can be similarly compared to humans and our individuality. And so it really breathes a lot of life into the work that we do with dogs, because there's a tendency for people on the outside to view the dog training as sort of almost mechanical. Mm-hmm. I think that kind of goes back to even some of our early philosophical roots, like the years of Descartes and how he viewed animals as these automatrons, basically. And then moving forward in our ethical discussion, how now currently we're viewing more and more dogs specifically as being sentient beings that have individual likes and dislikes, and that they're not just something that we can approach like a machine.
So in a way, like, this makes sense, because you guys don't call it obedience school. You don't call it, this training so that they can behave. I remember one of the first things that you guys, that in the class that I took with Curtis, it was like, we are here to create a relationship with you and your dog. And to strengthen that over time through certain principles of having that dog eventually gets to see you as more interesting than anything else in the world, that they want to, you know, be your pal. They want to, you know, serve and make you happy. And right, versus like, well, what I say when I do it just because.
Correct. View that relationship as reciprocal. And just kind of like you said, you know, even the nuance of the language of calling our classes companionship classes versus obedience classes has been a detail that the group I train with places in importance and how it might impact the message that we're communicating. Because generally, you know, our philosophy is about education. It's our approach and our ultimate goal and objective is to help the relationship between the dog and the owner. So that we can, and essentially ends up being the humans that tend to modify most of their behavior to work with the dog in this case. For me, it's largely about understanding the dog itself and what sort of genetics might have been designed for what its work was at one point, or understanding, you know, its actual individual likes and the things they're interested in, so we can tap into those things and give it a life through us that can reward its what people would call obedient skills or things like that. So the giving the dog the opportunity then to make choices in life and to gain the understanding of their own self-awareness through that process of I unlock a door by sitting in front of the door, you know, is different than the obedience perspective of you sit in front of this door because I make you do it, and the intimidation that tends to come with the legacy of dog training, which is compulsory based. Again, you know, that's kind of that mechanical aspect of the legacy of dog training I was talking about. It's more about, in some people's eyes, that strict obedience is about, you'll do what I tell you when I tell you, mm-hmm. and not joining up with the animal and understanding that there's both perspectives at stake, both the human and the dog. How can we mediate this concept or these conflicts that we might be experiencing with our relationship with the dog so that the dog's getting what it needs and we get what we need out of it as well?
Well, that's so interesting, Paul, because I was thinking about, again, like right now, my husband and I have been going through this parenting classes called Nurtured Heart. And, you know, it's same parallel with education. You know, we did kind of have a more disciplinary approach to education for children. And I think now we're learning more and more that, you know, that approach, whether it's parenting or education, doesn't work. And so it's fascinating. I'm curious, you know, how you got involved with what you're doing. And if you could describe a little bit, because you help, you know, with the training, but you also do some kind of nonprofit therapy work. Can you kind of explain what you do in those two different realms and how you got started in it?
Yeah, so basically my background education-wise comes from the University of Texas here in Austin, and I have a degree in psychology through them. And after I graduated with my bachelor's, I went on to start working in the field of human behavior, actually working at one of the facility sites that Divine Canines currently serves. It's called the Austin State Supported Living Center now. It used to be called Austin State School. And, you know, it's a facility in town for individuals who have profound mental retardation all the way up to, you know, high level self-care. You know, there's a very wide range of clients that we serve out there. But anyways, it's a residential facility for individuals like that. And I started cutting my teeth in behavior out there, working with people. And I was really passionate about it. I was very emotionally connected with working with that population. I always joke with people that know my personal background, because my daddy's a retired Lutheran minister these days. But part of his mission when he was a young pastor was service in the community. And as a young boy, at about the age of 6 or 7, I want to say it was, I started going to nursing homes with my dad on visits. And I joke because I was his therapy dog. I was the kid being brought in that situation for a similar purpose as therapy dogs. So I already had sort of this overarching viewpoint and perspective from just the tangibleness of my experiences in that support part of my life. I had experienced the power of just seeing a person in a sedentary environment that's more vulnerable light up to something simple as just a kid being around with them, and realize just how much dignity and respect tends to be sort of removed from people instantly that go into these types of settings. Mm-hmm. The level of vulnerability that people just don't understand right off the bat, mm-hmm, with what people ending up in these facilities tend to feel. And so I experienced that in the therapy dog world. You'll get a lot of similarities. So-and-so hasn't wanted to leave their room for X amount of time, and now they're out as part of the incentive of working with the dog. Or even more uncanny experiences that are even harder to explain, where, you know, people going through traumatic brain injury or maybe Alzheimer's dementia diagnoses and things like that, that might not be remembering the family members that are coming to see them, but yet they tend to remember the dogs week to week, right? And just this sort of almost mysticalness and innateness in this, the experience itself, that draws the person out of its shell, so to speak, without effort, you know, really. It's really more of the process, I think. And I don't have any science to back this up. One of the things that I've always thought with this therapy dog work is that it somehow allows people through nostalgia to uncover some memories that they've buried that we're not bringing to our conscious level regularly when we're in those states. Hmm. So for some reason, you know, just the presence of the dog alone and the handler, of course, as part of that team, can really start making connections that are off the like chart. There's been some amazing stories and things that you can't explain elsewise.
So with your work with the therapy dogs, you know, for Divine, I think it's called Divine Canines, right? That work that you're doing with the therapy, did you start doing training with dogs first and then start doing the therapy? Or did you go into the therapy and then think, oh, I can help owners with their dogs? Kind of how did that work out for you once you finished school and the path you took?
I hear you. It's such a strange endeavor, to be honest with you, to try to do dog training in general. And at the time that I was endeavoring to do it, you know, as I researched everything, it was like I was getting like all these zero hits on things. Like, how do I even do this? I had never thought about working formally with dogs at that point. I just knew that in my life, as far back as I could remember, since I was about 3 years old, I intrinsically love dogs and have always had a good connection with them. And I was just thinking of things at that moment. I remember just what are things that just make me intrinsically feel happy. And I stopped dogs all of a sudden. Let's go with that thread. What is that going to lead us to? And then we discovered therapy dog work as a concept. So I basically just teamed up with a local dog trainer and behaviorist that happened to be starting Divine Canines. It was sort of like a perfect fit for me. And everything just started working out from there.
Were you ever approached with the idea of empathy in and of itself? Were you ever taught of like the principles of empathy, or has it played a direct role? Or how do you think about empathy in your work?
Yeah. And honestly, I would say that I'll operate under that principle without even discussing it that way. But that's mm-hmm. one of the reasons that all these mechanisms started clicking, because again, you're going out there starting to research, just like with the parenting books, so do dog train, you're mm-hmm. realizing that, you know, about 75% the trainers in Austin are doing it with compulsory training, pinch, shock, choke. There's a massive amount of people here actually doing it that way still. And those are things that I was never interested in. I always call myself lucky because I entered into this in a culture that never, ever used those things and was only interested in building relationship and utilizing more positive rewards to get the influence with the dogs. And so I kind of consider myself lucky to never have to have grown up in the predominant culture of what's referred to as choke and reward.
Is there an example you could share about, you know, I'm thinking you have to empathize with the owner, right? They're coming to you for help. There's probably there's a problem or they're trying to learn how to live together or, you know, yeah. So you have this, all of you, I suppose you'd have to empathize with the owner, but then you're also having to empathize with their dog, right? So could you give an example of how translating it or addressing it?
I'll use a common example, right? It's very typical for us to get clients who basically have come out to the center because they've been pretty badly matched with a pet that they've adopted, essentially. So you're a person that was really interested in walking a dog once a week, and instead of going out and getting a Chihuahua, you decide to get a Border Collie, right? And it's just basically that kind of mismatch, right?
Require a lot more care, huh? They have different needs and personalities, like you were saying.
That's right. And here's a very interesting tidbit about what I do. I talk about this quite a bit in my training, actually. I will sometimes have groups of people stand around and just ask the question, who here has a dog out of a breed category referred to as companion dog? Because when you look in breed encyclopedias and the way that, you know, breeding clubs and things like that have categorized dogs, they're categorized based on their working purposes typically. And so one of the categories you'll find is called companion dog. These are dogs like our little Cavalier King Charles Spaniels or little poodles or pugs, you know, all kinds of breeds that our forefathers were selecting for the work of companionship. It's a different question than asking a person why they got their dog, because a person that gets a Border Collie and expects the Border Collie to be a companion has still made that choice of, I wanted a companion as a dog. It just didn't select the dog that our forefathers were designing for that type of work, right? So a Border Collie, one of the most intelligent breeds in the world and one of the more active breeds in the world. You know, at one point in our history, you wouldn't have found them anywhere except for in England or Ireland or Scotland, the British Isles, essentially doing their job herding. And now we find, you know, huskies down here in Texas. You know, you have to wonder how that happened. You know, things get transplanted, right? And people kind of get mismatched with that. And so I have to understand, you know, first of all, from the perspective of the owner, I haven't met any dog owners in my entire time of doing this that came to me and said, Paul, I selected this dog from this shelter with the intent of giving it back to the shelter. You know, that was, there's never an owner I've met that had the intent of going out and getting a dog just to give it back. But yet it happens frequently enough because of these mismatches. So I have to understand, why did they get the dog? What's the purpose of it? What is their level of interest? What can they actually manage? And what is the dog's needs on that, right? So if this family takes on this Border Collie, what will be the, you know, the happiness quotient for the dog and the family both? Because we're basically going to have to find some levels of compromise, right? If we lump, I can get you to do a very complex behavior program with your dog. And if at the end of the day, part of that program is getting the dog more exercise and you're just refusing to give the dog more exercise, we may have some limitations there. You know, I might have to ask a person to step outside of their threshold of comfort and take on a bit more of that in trade-off for something else, let's say, in the program. So there's going to be always this sort of need for both entities' goals and needs to be addressed throughout the entire process of helping them become more of a like each other and be able to kind of work with each other in a bit more compromised viewpoint.
So what does the owner have to do then for, you know, like that makes total sense, you know, educating on kind of the dog and the needs of the particular breeds and the personality that you're seeing. And then for the dog, is it all rewards based or are there other things you have to do with the dogs to then empathize with the owner's needs? Is there anything the reverse or is it mostly rewards based?
Yeah, there's some costs to the dog that will happen along the way as well. Now, it's arguable that the dog doesn't get a lot of decision-making in that process necessarily in the sense that they don't have a voice that says, no, Paul, you're right. I want this. So we do the best we can through stereotyping breeds and looking at what the owner already knows anecdotally about the dog's personality, and basically using self-reporting by the owner about the dog, which is, again, is already entering into a level of bias, isn't it? Because, you know, we're having to trust the person now to seek those things for us as well. But I find that we know enough about dog behavior and reading the dog. My mentor, Lee Mannix, used to tell people, you know, every time you walk into my office with your dog, I know what you've been doing for your homework, because your dog doesn't lie. You do, right? People lie. Dogs don't. The dog will show us through A, their behavior, their level of training, the way they're interacting with the experience or whatever. But still, we've got to, again, blend that together and be able to mediate both sides of that. And I'll sometimes have to say things like, well, hey, if you can't get the dog some exercise and maybe you're choosing to use your money here right now with this, with the dog, maybe we use some of those funds for you to hire a dog sitter to come in and do that instead.
So as a trainer, you're practicing that level of, you take the time to understand what the situation is with your dog, the matching, the mismatching of the dog. So even before applying any kind of recommendations of the training, you do take the time to understand, right? Which is kind of the whole basis of your teachings between a dog and their owner.
That's correct. Exactly right. So you have to sort of role model that from the front end as well, right? If you come in to see and you absolutely feel like I don't care about your needs, it's not likely that you're going to follow my advice, right? Mm-hmm. It's not likely the dog's going to be helped in the long run. And honestly, because of everything I just said, you can tell that the first aspect of our evaluations end up being a lot of interviewing of the actual people to gain the information we need to go forward. Mm-hmm. Part of that is because of the bias I was talking about earlier, because it happens to all of us. You know, when you're emotional about something and you're describing it, you're going to describe things in a way that's a bit more polarized to your emotional perspective. And oftentimes we say there's no emergencies in dog training, because, you know, if you actually had a dog emergency, you'd be calling an emergency vet, not us, you know, because there's always the capability of putting a dog somewhere and walking away for a little bit, you know, and that's just necessary sometimes. It's like, just like in parenting, you might need to just walk away for a moment.
Absolutely.
Dude, just make sure keep the kid's safe. Same thing with dogs. So there's going to be damage or, you know, collateral damage or things that people give up on both sides of the spectrum, because that's what compromise entails. But I find that if you can, and here's where it kind of circles back into some of the empathy. One of the, you know, we have to relate to the owner enough to make an emotional connection with them, to allow them the ability to kind of relax enough to loosen up, to gain therapeutic intimacy with us, to share their story honestly enough for us then to work on the actual relationship with the dog, because there's such a tendency for there to be huge amounts of guilt in this industry. Now, I'll use another example from another mentor, John Rogerson, English behaviorist. He kind of brings up an English lady named Gwen Bailey, who's well known in the shelter system and has written quite a few books in England. One that's a great puppy rearing book called The Perfect Puppy, actually, that I highly recommend. But one of the things she does in the shelters is she's trying to always kind of think through the dog and human perspective. And one of the things she's realized over the years is that people that come back to shelters and turn dogs in are actually the good dog owners of our lives. They're the ones that are envisioning a better life for their dogs. They're not just laying them out on the streets, they're not just getting rid of them, right? They're actually probably feeling quite guilty about what they've done. And they're trying to get this dog a better life. And so one of the things she's done is when you come into the shelter that she's working at, her questions are geared essentially, instead of asking you, how much exercise did you give this dog? Instead, she asks, the perfect home that you're envisioning for this dog would be able to provide about how much exercise, right? The perfect home that you're envisioning for this dog would be able to give this dog how much toy play per day, right? Instead of how much did you do, it's how much do you envision this dog needing, so that we don't get so defensive right off the bat like humans will, you know? And we think it through a little bit more and say, well, what do I want for the life of this dog? Because that's what these owners are probably dreaming about anyways. What do I want this dog to do? I want it to have a better life.
That immediately puts them into, let's not think about me, you know, this is like, what is this animal? What is this person, this creature needs? Right.
I was just thinking the same thing, Nelson, like, because the theme that seems to keep coming back, Paul, that you've mentioned several times is compromise. And that, you know, I think a lot of times it seems like people go get a pet because they want the companion, as you say, but they just want what they want, and they just want it the way they want it in their head without thinking that the other creature has needs. And it's, and you know, so it's like, it's the compromise that has to happen on both sides. It's a training of the mind of just different expectations, I guess, too, you know, what it means to have a pet.
The instinctual needs of a border collie wanting to be out in the field all the time, herding cows and other animals. And then being faced with, well, I live in a house with a yard or an apartment or something. So, and all of a sudden something's not being fulfilled. So he's already compromising by just being there. So it's like, how do we meet in the middle?
And that's right.
That translates to, well, let's make sure we get enough time in the park, you know, a few times a week for at least half an hour and some toys so you can be engaged mentally and challenged with these cool exercises.
Well, and Nelson, I think you have a specific example early on that you were sharing with me about Rambo and, you know, having to do that compromise.
Yes, yes. Well, it was one of these cases of whether it was take, take, take and no giving. You know, at this point, I've had Rambo for about a year and a half or so, and the relationship is going really well, and he's super well-behaved, and we're doing a lot of things together. And last December, we go on this road trip from here in Austin down to Florida. And so on this road trip, he's having to compromise because he's spending a lot of time inside a car. He's spending time in my brother's house and my friend's house and in places that he's not familiar with. And most people know that dogs, they like things to be the same in familiarity most of the time. So he's staying, you know, as a guest in these places that he's not familiar with. So, you know, this is a two and a half weeks. We're on this road trip. We get back to Austin. And that whole time, he was very well behaved. And when I get back, you know, it's cold and I'm sort of being lazy about the walks and things like that. And, you know, the evening walks are super short. Just go into the yard and come right back inside, right? And we're not going to the park. So a couple of days go by after we return. And the one night, I wake up to a big pile of poop next to my bed. Not in the corner of the room because he's embarrassed or because he had to go and he couldn't hold it. But it was right next to my bed where I place my feet when I wake up. And the first night I thought, oh man, I guess he really needed to go. I feel bad for him. I'll make sure his food is in order and all that stuff. Happens again two nights in a row, the same spot, same location. I'm like, and instead of getting angry, like I knew there was something was up, and I realized, like, oh my God, I'm not giving you what you need in terms of going out and playing and getting time to smell the, you know, smell things and stuff like that. And so that's when I immediately knew that I wasn't doing my part. And that was his way of saying, hey, F you, like, you know, you got to take me
pretty
out.
Pretty clear communication more.
Yeah, very clear communication. And I think probably in a different time or another person would have been upset at the dog and try to do some sort of corrective action, you know, have him smell it or something like that, or punish him or something. And I think through the training, I learned, wow, this is a sign. This is a way of communicating that something's not right. And
I mean, honestly, I mean, what Nelson's seeing the nail on the head over here is that because dogs don't have the ability to tell you things, they're going to show you through their behavior. And that's kind of how I'm asking my clients to look at things. You know, I have a relationship with my German Shore Pointer that's really close. He's a dog I work for, a therapy dog for Divine Canines. And I can tell when something's just a little bit off or something like that just by watching his behavior. And that's going to give me some more information that I need to maybe carry out the next action. If it's something that's bothering him for long enough, I might need to take him to the vet over it. You know, if it's something that I can identify, like a change in my routine, like Nelson's kind of talking about, which is absolutely heavily impactful for dogs, changes in routine, then I can pinpoint that source and start saying to myself, oh, how can I modify things? If I can't go back to doing the amount of exercise I was giving the dog, let's say, is there a way for me to compromise a little bit and use more food puzzle work to get more mental fatigue out of the dog, let's say, as a compromise to the lack of exercise here and there that gives the dog a little bit more of what it needs to? Because there's going to be certain realities to life. And again, I'm trying to always get people to stop kind of feeling guilty about things and just move forward with it, you know, because we kind of get ourselves caught in these cycles of guilt. I think that's where a lot of people kind of end up stewing. Because another tone of what you were just talking about, Nelson, tends to be the hardest thing, I think, that for owners to grasp, I think, working with their dogs. And it's that the dogs really not trying to piss them off. It feels personal at those moments. And then we'll anthropomorphize for dogs, you know? We're very bad about that as humans, and we'll start giving them a lot of human traits. And reality is that the dog is using some level of its instinct and experience to just navigate the world. And honestly, you have to always remember that we're the ones defining that for the dog. You know, people will constantly come to me.
And create their world.
That's right. And we define that part. Remember, what's a naughty behavior to a dog? Tell me, right? Because you think the dog would answer the question the same way? You know, people come to me and say, oh, I've got a naughty dog. It jumps up on people. Well, as a trainer, I don't see that as a naughty dog. I see that as a dog that has been tooled to understand that the way I gain attention is jumping up on people. And so when people come to me and express that behavior issue, they'll commonly express it and word it, hey, Paul, how can I get my dog to stop jumping up on people? I've been doing this for a long time. So I've got a filter in my brain that automatically reformats that. And I hear you say, Paul, during social meet and greets, what should my dog be doing instead of jumping up on them? You understand? And so people will automatically want to jump to, because we're wired to be reactive and we kind of tend to focus on the negative a bit. We want to get on it as if it's the dog's problem. Well, a dog jumping up on somebody has never, ever been literally a naughty dog. It's that in the perspective of the human world, that can cause some issues. And for the therapy dog world specifically, jumping up behavior is considered a taboo behavior, because in the therapy dog world, if a dog jumps up on somebody and accidentally creates, let's say, a scratch on an elderly person in a nursing home, and that scratch turns into a secondary infection, that can be a massive snowball for the human side of things, you know, in terms of the health consideration there. But I still wager to say that if that dog did that, that doesn't mean that's a naughty dog. It means it's a dog that's understanding its world to show it that it gets more attention from placing itself on somebody than for sitting to get greeted. And just like us as humans, I find that to be partly created through habit. And if you're honestly asking yourself who's driving that dog's habit day in and day out, who's mostly responsible for that?
It's another human.
I have to guess it's going to be a human, because...
So you bring that point, maybe we can elaborate on that, is the human side of it. So you're saying that the habit as humans, we kind of create for ourselves. Just explain what that means in terms of habits and how that connects with our relationship with one another as humans and empathy.
I view it exactly the same way. I mean, remember, habit is the repetition of a behavior over and over again. Honestly, it's most oftentimes viewed as something that's unconsciously attained, right? So it's not that if you think about your actual habits that you recognize after the fact that you were thinking about them forming the entire time, it's the repetition of the regular tendency itself and the practice of that behavior that will literally lead it to become a habit, right? A custom, a practice, a pattern, whatever you want to describe it. So I think that we talk about that in the human world the same way. And this is why empathy as a topic of discussion and placing importance in empathy to me is such an important part of our goal in life as people. Because to be honest with you, part of what I'm trying to do with therapy dog work is to bring people tangibly together to practice compassion. And people don't think of compassion as something that we have to continue to practice. They think of it oftentimes as something that exists or doesn't exist. But I believe that just like a lot of our habits in life, if we can get people thinking more through empathy so that we care about the emotional experience that other people are having, not just I'm sympathetic to your situation, but I have so much sympathy and so much emotion invested in this for another person or another animal that I want to, it's going to move me to do something specifically tangible for somebody.
So in a form of compromise, like compromise is one way that shows up, because I took the time to understand what this other person or what this other dog experiences or has been or whatever habits they have, I'm able to better strategize on how to compromise or how to incentivize a different behavior.
Correct. And then people start becoming able to then flesh out a bit more of what's really important to them in that relationship, right? Because we do have my mentor used to, Lee Max would tell people that a true behavior issue is something you give your dog back to the shelter over. That's something that's a true behavior issue. Otherwise, we've got varying degrees of tolerance going on here. And actually, even that is a varying degree of tolerance, isn't it? It's just the extreme version of it. Like, I can't deal with this anymore. You're going back to the shelter. So we're just really dealing with varying levels of tolerance there that a person can or can't deal with and what they've just told themselves that their life with this dog is going to be. So essentially helping people kind of sort through that, maybe get more comfortable with some of these quote unquote naughty behaviors that are really, you know, not bothering them that much. But
what would be an equivalent to that in the human world? Okay, so we see a naughty behavior when a dog jumps on somebody to greet them. What would be, you know, so you label this quote unquote naughty, but to that creature, it's just, oh, this is what I do, and this is to get attention, or this is how I like to greet people.
Right, these are right. Easy questions to ask about kids, especially yeah. Mine.
So like example for kids, like what would you say is equivalent?
You know, my kid, who's my son, he's 8, and he's considered a pretty well-behaved guy at school, and you know, pretty cool. He got pretty amped up the other night. We had some guests over, and he took a plastic ball, those kind that come with ball pits that you jump in, and that they play a little simulated baseball with in our little playroom. And he threw it at grandma's face and hit her the ball. And it's a, you know, it's a light ball. It's not going to hurt her, right? Really, in the long run. But it's not the most appropriate thing to be doing with grandma at the moment.
No.
Yeah. But grandma doesn't turn around and say, oh my God, you just threw a ball in my face. You're a horrible little kid, you know? It's not that one act that's going to define him, right? And in that moment, we have to have a little empathy for what he's going through, because arguably he'd been given a bit too much sugar. He's influencing the sugar in the kid's life. My grandma, or you know, his grandma was, and for that, right? And she's the one that's made a choice to give him donut holes that morning and then go out and blah, blah, blah. You know, so as a parent, me doing that, there's lots of levels of empathy having to go on here. I've got to understand what grandma's going through too. I've got to understand from the parenting side that if I make a mountain out of every molehill, then I'm going to drive one other certain level of response from my son's side on things. And in the middle, what's the overall goal? Well, what basically ended up happening was we just basically talk it through a little bit, have him apologize. We talk about it a little bit before bedtime. We acknowledge both sides of what was happening. We talk about our plan for the next day, and we try to move on from it and learn, right?
Isn't it funny, too, thinking about it's the realization that this never ends. Need for continual reflection and mindfulness, you know, mm-hmm. because it's so easy to fall into habits and routines in how we interact with one another or how we live our day-to-day life. And it's that mindfulness that allows you to stop and say, okay, let's think about this before we react. But it's so hard because it forces you to have to look inward. And I wonder, you know, is it hard sometimes for the owners to accept the fact that many of those issues they may be having with their dog are due to their own behaviors? And are they resistant to changing?
Oh my, yes. I mean, it's such the massive struggle I'm talking about with that guilt syndrome, because, mm-hmm. I mean, you kind of talked about it a little bit ago, I think. You just kind of mentioned the fact that, I mean, we're taking animals on as pets, right? I mean, if you really want to back up the discussion to the point at which we make a decision to bring an animal into our life, ourselves, right? Especially in our current culture, that animal didn't get that choice per se. Not to say that our kids are given the choice to be born or any of that either. And our hope is that, you know, and especially in our Austin community, that's quite dog friendly. Their hope is that we're getting dogs out of shelters and trying to match them in better homes and trying and making this attempt. So if you constantly shoot yourself in the foot over what you view as the result right now, and don't think a little bit about the dream of what could be, then you're going to find yourself very limited in what you're going to be achieved with the relationship with your dog or your kids, I think. And that's because you're kind of their guardian, right? And so we have to view it that way. It's also one of the things that's so scary about working with dogs sometimes that I have to acknowledge for people and just lead them into that gently. You know, it's scary that you're taking on that responsibility for another living animal sometimes. And that, I mean, a lot of owners there are just definitely afraid just to even let go of the leash for a moment or anything, because they're afraid that dog's going to choose running off away from them and leave them behind,
yeah. You know? Yeah, the first time I took him to the park, Zilker Park out here, you know, it's no leash and I was nervous. You know, I had just had a few weeks with him and I had to just trust that he's going to stick around and come when I called him and just trust in the relationship and not that he's going to scoot on out and run into the street or something.
Exactly. And that's built off of just, you know, the history that you have and going out and doing your training and testing things in sensible ways, much like, you know, the difference between me taking my son out on a bounce bike when he was 3 or 4 versus riding with a pedal bike now at 8. And does he know more about the information of the street now? Yeah. Does he know how to stop at stops on corners more? Yes. Can you be could I trust a 4-wheel to do that? No. Right. So we have to acknowledge the growth in the relationship. And I believe that's the beauty of it. We learn from each other. We, you know, when you're expressing empathy, you're giving people the opportunity to share themselves with you, and you're giving yourself the opportunity to share yourself with others and try to really come to terms with how our likenesses can pull us together as well. I think it's a higher level of the relationship, because I think it becomes a more honest and transparent aspect of the relationship at that moment, where we're developing the true trust, you know, that building of trust through reciprocity over a longer period of time to make that judgment. And I think therefore it lends itself to a bit more solidness in terms of the connection, and a bit more than, in my opinion, more fulfilling personally, the way I would describe it. Because I think ultimately then we can be a bit more balanced in our perspective of how we cohabitate with one another and share with one another and take from one another in ways that are kind of like-minded and moving us all forward.
There's so much to be learned from dogs. Like you said at the very beginning, we can learn from our pets just as much as we can learn from other people. And I think that coming to that compromise, that idea that for empathy, we have to have compromise. And I think that's true. It sounds like with the dogs, definitely true in our lives. It's just, I think that mindfulness, it's like I'm taking away from this, that importance for continual reflection and kind of level-headedness and compromise. I think those are really neat themes that came out of the discussion. And thank you so much for sharing your story and your expertise.
Thank you guys so much for inviting me. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you for listening to another episode of the Empathy Podcast. Be sure to visit our website at www.empathypodcast.com. And if you have any questions, thoughts, or suggestions, feel free to send us an email at hello@empathypodcast.com. Also, find us on Facebook by searching Empathy Podcast, and be sure to tune in for the next episode.